Hello and welcome back to the Gathered Dispatch for another month. Boy, do I have an exciting one for you now. I see self-effacing looks here. Y'all don't agree with that, but I promise you this is an exciting one. I'm excited to be with you. I'm going to go around the room. First, to my left, returning guest, copywriter, content strategist, what do you want? How many things you want in front?
Those sound good.
Okay.
Writer, editor.
Yep. Writer, editor, copywriter, content strategist, all-around brilliant person at Gather.
Oh, thank you.
Kirsten Chen. Welcome back.
Hello. Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
And to Kirsten's left, a writer, editor, content strategist at Gather, Molly Osberg. First time. Welcome.
First time.
Thrilled to have you here. And another first-timer to her left, Gita Jackson.
Hello. I'm Gita. That's who I am.
What more do you need to know?
You really don't need to know anything else about me. I'm just Gita.
I copywriter and editor, content strategist, and independent business guru.
Oh, boy. I don't know if I'm the guru.
Would you like to be a maven or?
I'll take maven.
Okay.
Enthusiast. I started a fucking website with my friends. You know, that's what it is. We all got together. We bought a domain name. Surprisingly easy. We started a website. There you go.
If that's not a maven, I don't know what it is. And honestly, I don't know what is,
because
I'm very unsure how to use that word.
Don't
but they
tell
used
me
it.
What a maven is. Yeah. I don't want to know. I feel like I'm using it correctly, and I don't want to be corrected by anyone.
Yes. Leave me in the dark, please. We will answer no calls. So what I want to talk about this month is an extension of earlier conversations we've had this year on how deeply weird the internet is this year and how much trouble everyone is having figuring out what to put on it and how to monetize it and where to put things and how long they're going to exist. And a part of that ecosystem we have not covered is the independent media ecosystem, the independent digital media ecosystem. And so Gita, as somebody who started a website and says it's very easy, and Molly, as somebody who's a great portion of your career has been an independent and semi-independent and swallowed by corporate behemoth media structures, I would like to pick your brains on what on earth is going on online out there. And hopefully we will get some sense from that about how independent collectives like Gather and like Aftermath and like 404 Defector and all the other good media companies now are trying to survive and organize people around the project of, I don't know, existing in a digital space and paying our bills. So, I mean, I got a couple minutes. So you think we can solve all that?
I'm pretty sure we can solve all
of
that.
Oh, totally. Yeah, for sure.
Great.
Yeah.
So
right.
What is
Let's
it like?
Save media.
We've been trying. I personally have been trying. What is it like out there? It's bad.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, just so you know.
All right, see y'all next month. Well, how bad is it and why?
I mean, Molly and I used to work at the same company twice, I think. Mm-hmm. And we both have had, I think, a pretty similar experience of media. So just check me if this narrative checks out to you. There was a time when newspapers were things that people bought every day, and they had like classified sections, and
yeah,
there was a robust functioning ecosystem, financial ecosystem that allowed newspapers to work and to fund journalism. But then the internet was invented, and a lot of newspapers, as like a fun, cool treat, were like, why don't we just put all our articles on a website for free? And since that time, media as an industry has tried to figure out how to fund that model, right? They've tried ads, they've tried paywall, they've tried subscription newsletters and subscription-based services, et cetera. So nothing has worked, and the bottom of that is just beginning to completely fall out in earnest. And we experienced that at Geo Media, formerly Gawker. Gawker had its own problems, which we do not have enough time to get into right now. But Geo Media as an entity, we had websites when we worked there. Those websites were extremely popular. Kotaku, the one I worked at, had this is like a very rare achievement for a website. A lot of people we knew from our analytics literally typed Kotaku.com to go there and like visited the homepage every day.
Yeah.
They weren't just clicking on links that they got from Google. They were devoted readers of Kotaku and visited every single day, multiple times a day.
And I think that was true of a lot of the properties there. Like,
I think
they had
so too.
Really strong followings. Yeah.
Deadspin was the one of the biggest. Deadspin is just like a phenomenon.
So I guarantee even readers who aren't familiar with how that media group was structured would recognize almost all of these. So Defector, Gizmodo.
Defector, Wolf, Deadspin.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Deadspin, Gizmodo, Kotaku.
Jezebel.
Jezebel.
IO9, even. You know, it's a subsite of Gizmodo, but there are IO9 readers that specifically get all their science fiction news from IO9.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Jalopnik for cars.
Yep. Jalopnik for cars. Yep. We love cars. Vroom, vroom.
Man, I used to ask those Jalopnik guys questions about my car constantly. It was so nice being in the office with
them. I would just text one of them. I forget which one. I would just text him pictures of cool cars I saw in Brooklyn. What car is this? Hey, what car is this? It was really fun. Theoretically, if you have brand name recognition like that, it should be really easy to make money.
Yeah.
But we wrote stuff that was also really adversarial, like all the time. Sometimes a little too adversarial.
I disagree. I think it's a totally appropriate amount of adversarial,
fair
frankly.
Enough. I think at Kotaku we could have gone a lot harder, but that's also neither here nor there. But everybody that managed our site like discovered that advertisers were reluctant to run ads against the things that we were writing because we were trying to do what I really wanted to work at a Geo Media Group site since I was in college, because they just said stuff that was true and didn't care who it angered. Yeah. And that, to me, is like an essential function of journalism and how it should operate.
Yeah.
Like, it should just make people angry all the time, especially the people that have lots of money and are determining whether or not we all live or die. I think those people should feel bad all the time.
Yeah. And especially, I think that, one of the big things that I remember from working at Jezebel was that this was something that was particularly difficult with Jezebel.com, because a lot of those, like, unsafe words, especially towards the end of the site's run, were things like abortion.
Yes.
Yeah. And so when you're covering those subjects, like, even if you're not being adversarial, like, those keywords are just going to show up.
Yeah, no, yeah. There was a during the Me Too movement, there were a lot, like, almost daily, there were different stories about sexual assault on the website. And it's difficult to try to sell that as an ad package to a prospective advertiser. Yeah. Like, please run your advertisements against all of these very important but traumatizing articles about the worst days of people's lives.
Yeah. Sure. So the broader challenge here is that we had developed this ecosystem where the user base expected things to be free, and the ways in which bills were paid were advertising. And when you scale to a certain point, you need advertisers of a certain size, and they are almost necessarily more squeamish about the kinds of content that lives next to their advertisements.
Uh-huh.
They want the lists.
They want
listicles.
They want slideshows. They want lists.
Oh, they love slideshows. Oh, my God.
Because that's a lie. Slideshows are a lie.
Exactly. Yeah. All the clicks.
I know. Yeah.
People have to click through stuff, like, sometimes, like, 20 or 30 times. It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's a gold mine.
Just count all the clicks, and the more clicks, the more ads you can get on the page.
Yeah.
You know? People hate ads on a page, though. People really hate it. People do not like to look at a page with ads on it.
Yeah.
People do not like to look at a page that has automatically playing videos on it.
Correct.
Is automatically playing videos with sound on it either.
Yeah.
Several different automatically playing videos with sound. They
and this is a, this is a problem that compounded, because as we learned that people didn't like ads on their media, we put more of them rather than find ways to put less of them.
Yep. Yeah, uh-huh.
Yeah.
And there's, like, other different things that have changed, too. Like, there's a very recently Google has changed how page rankings work. And Geo Media and a lot of different media companies will have a sort of, like, e-commerce-styled site. We had the inventory, which is you basically have writers who scour, who may have deals with Amazon and other different retailers where they're like, this is on sale if you click this link, and we get a cut of that money. And that's, like, a great, like, what, tertiary revenue stream. It's really easy. And if you were, like, I don't know, like a wire cutter or something, and people really trust your recommendations, then that's also really helpful. But now Google has changed how their SEO ranking works, and things with affiliate links are ranked significantly lower, to the point where a lot of sites, especially in tech and video games, journalism, they lost like 60%. That's how much they fell down the page rankings. So, also slaves to Google. Also, there's this whole scandal in there where Facebook lied to us about the streaming on there.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a mess. Yeah. You know, it's been a mess for my entire career. And I feel like, you know, I've been in journalism for, you know, like a little over a decade at this point. And my foundational experience of working in newsrooms has been like getting a job, doing the job pretty well, waking up one morning to a random calendar notification, getting inside of a room and having somebody that I've never seen before be like, yeah, sorry, you guys all left your jobs.
Yeah,
fucking sick, right?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. So
my Vice layoff, I've told the story a lot of times. I was crying. The person laying me off was crying. I was in an airport on the way to a wedding. And as soon as the layoff finished, they were calling my flight to board. And I had to scream. I was freaking out. But a great place to go after you get laid off is a wedding of two people that are very in love. So that was nice. Yeah. But don't recommend getting laid off in an airport right before you board a flight.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I think that's bad.
Well, I mean, the extent to which misery loves company, at least you are in very good company because everyone has been laid off.
Yes.
There are how many stable media jobs left in digital media? Like zero?
Yeah, maybe half of one.
Yeah, I think that there are like two and they're both of the New York Times.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to say, if you're somehow an op-ed writer at the New York Times, you will never be moved.
Yeah.
But anyone else in the world, you're in trouble.
Which is also, you know, just as an aside, I was thinking about this while we were talking about the sort of origins of this problem. You might want to fact check me on this, but I'm pretty sure that it's actually—
I won't.
That I'm pretty sure that it's actually the New York Times' fault in large part that so many websites were free for so long and that there was no like subscription model or like paywall or anything.
Okay.
And that the New York Times was they made their stuff free and then sort of all the big papers.
I think you're right
lead.
About that, yeah. Actually. I think also the New York Times, especially compared to other legacy journalism outlets that had moved to digital journalism, they took a really long time to catch up with the norms of journalism that's performed on the internet too, like linking to people whose stories you've read and are sourcing. In this other story, it's happened to me dozens of times. Chris Person, who is one of the people at Aftermath, the website I started, he recently was interviewed for an article for the New York Times, and I didn't even mention that he works for Aftermath on it.
Of course.
Yeah, of course. Normal stuff.
Yeah.
But they get to do whatever they want because they have lots of money and lots of prestige, and they're like the newspaper that people have heard of.
Mm-hmm.
So, whatever.
We briefly touched on Facebook on the way through this journey. Let's not spend too much time on the autopsy here, but it is worth mentioning what Facebook did to everyone
when they
lied about what constitutes a play of streaming video on
bald face lies
their website. Yes. Who wants to just quickly give people the TikTok on what happened there?
Being in video game journalism throughout this, also, I was dealing with like another aspect of this is that in certain forms of journalism that are more contentious, like the stuff that you guys did at Jezebel and the stuff that, weirdly enough, the stuff that we were doing at Kotaku, which just has to deal with a lot of really weird, insular, extremely tedious nerds, they are also extremely just adversarial towards the people that are writing stuff. Uh-huh, so we were forced to go on live streams as ourselves at least once a week on Facebook because Facebook told us that views on their where we got like hundreds of thousands of views apparently for video. We wanted to expand outward into video. And then like, you know, one of those moments in the Geo Media office where I'm just sitting down at my desk and I hear like dozens of people laughing all around me from different parts of the office. And I finally get slacked the article they're looking at. And it's about how Facebook has just inflated the numbers of views on video like 1,000%.
Yeah.
Like they were not just lying a little bit about how many views we were getting. They were lying like so, so much. And it was based on completely nothing.
Right. Which also happened like right, you know, in like the year or two right after all of these huge newsroom reorganizations where they were like, psych, we're not really like in the business of text anymore. We're like, you know.
It's all video now.
Pivoting to video,
gotta
baby.
Pivot to video.
Love it. Yeah.
It's,
well, because part of this is after, not only did they say you should use Facebook video because these incredible numbers, they said you should bring your entire publishing outfit onto Facebook and eschew even having a website because why would you do that? That is just another barrier, another piece of friction between your viewer and you. Why don't you just come right to Facebook where they already are and make that your digital footprint?
So me and fucking Tim Rogers would get in front of a live stream and put together the entirely red Mario puzzle while a bunch of weird people on Facebook called me racial slurs. And then I found out that was all for nothing. Cool. So that's the landscape that we find ourselves in currently.
Yeah.
It was bad then. And then because the money the funders have pulled out and the advertisers hadn't met the demand that these websites want, it's not like just being profitable enough is enough either. Like they want exponential growth that is not possible to give with journalism. That's just not really how that works and not how it should work either. The money just disappeared. And you see this a lot. I think in almost every creative industry, I've heard the same story. A really, really good video game studio I like a lot, Degout de Fabrique, had to close recently because they couldn't secure funding for their next project. And they were a studio that is like nominated for several BAFTAs, critically acclaimed, and like a lot of other creative industries that could have probably scrounged up enough money to keep going. But that's not true. And that's true across the board, I think, everywhere in journalism. Vice is closed forever.
Yeah.
One thing I would add to that, though, is that the money didn't quite disappear.
Yes, fair.
You know, the money was there, and like most of it got paid out. Yeah, like the money got paid out to like executives and shareholders.
Oh, yeah. Finding out that the people in the C-suite advice were giving themselves bonuses that was more than my yearly salary when they laid me off was just like, if I ever see Nancy DeBute, I'm just, it's on site. That's all I'm saying.
Would it be fair to characterize that part of the challenge of digital journalism, digital media, is that it has been defined as a tech product, and therefore it needs tech-like returns when people invest in it. It needs to be part of, if not the totality of, a unicorn investment. So the mere achievement of staying above water and paying the people to do the things on the property that make it enough money for them to continue to be there is insufficient when you are hoping that it will return tech money.
Yes. Yep.
Yep.
I mean, you can see it in the work that gets published, too. Mm. And there's a lot of stories that I probably can't talk about that just I couldn't get past my editors because they knew that eventually someone, their boss, like my boss's boss, would not want to even begin to broach the subject of trying to put an article about sexual assault on the page. Mm. And you see a lot of articles that get a lot of hits but are also pretty substanceless and not very interesting and not very useful to the readers either. Yeah. But they're sensational.
The idea of every digital outfit being a tech company was like, is really this like bizarre relic that still exists from the years of like BuzzFeed and Upworthy. You know,
oh, yes.
Like we have these guys that are doing journalism, but they're also tech guys and they like cracked the code and now we can all make millions of dollars.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's just not going to happen. It's just not going to happen.
Right, which is why everybody has to start their own websites now.
Yeah.
There you go.
Absolutely.
Okay, so that's the problem. That is a very, also, applause all around. That is a blisteringly quick accounting of the problem. Well done.
I could write a movie about this. I feel like it's an incredibly fun story that's really depressing. But
yeah,
there's,
is.
Like, so many more different things that happened during this time.
Isn't this literally, like, a subplot line of Secession, though?
It literally is at this point. The office for Valter in Secession.
Valter, that's
yes. It looked like a hybrid of the Gawker office and the Vice office somehow. I don't know how they found that building that was the exact midpoint between those two.
Yeah. All right. Well, that brings us to the contemporary moment where people are trying to figure out if venture-funded tech-resembling media is not the answer for how to make sustainable journalistic projects or other media concerns. What kind of organizational makeup is? And this is where we skew closer to things that Gather really cares about. I think this is sort of, hopefully, part of the reason that we're all hanging out at Gather is that there is a sympathetic viewpoint of how people should assemble and do work together, whatever that kind of work is, you know, a mixture of client work and personal work or whatever it looks like. What structures to put in place so that people can opt into doing things that are helpful for them and have a very clear sense of what the give and take is there. For media concerns, what are those kind of organizations starting to look like?
Well, there's a small cohort now of worker-owned media websites. Worker-owned is like a pretty vague term, but it's essentially the idea is that there is no other layer of business people that we have to go through to publish things, and we just own all of our own work. Like, organizationally, there's a lot of different structures. I know Defector was really the big first one. Were you were still at Umedia, of course, when
Well, I was trying to remember if Racket predated, but I don't think it did.
I don't think so either.
Yeah, so I think a lot of it really was like we all owe like a huge debt to the staff of Deadspin
for
starting Defector and really like showing that this was something that would be possible. And it makes absolute sense that it's inspiring. I mean, not copycats, but people sort of like understanding that there is an audience and a way to organize these sort of like smaller concerns that are a little bit more niche, you know, not trying to do like everything under the sun, but have sort of like very dedicated readers, you know, and smaller staffs to focus on actually doing the work.
I mean, smaller staffs is certainly part of it. I imagine there is sort of less waste in management when things are collectively owned. How do you solve the fundamental problem of funding when it's not call up a rich guy and tell him that he's got 100x whatever he puts in the next decade?
Well, I mean, it's unsolved a little bit. Aftermath is a site I started with a bunch of my friends from Kotaku. I got a DM one day. And my friend Luke was like, get on this Google Meet call with me for a sec. Let's talk about something. And then by the end of the call, he brought me on board with a bunch of my former coworkers, Nathan Grayson, Chris Person, Luke Plunkett, and Riley McLeod. We all started a site together. And we talked a lot about how we were going to fund this, and we eventually settled on a subscription model, which is becoming pretty popular for writers who are trying to write independently. A lot of newsletters, this also coincided around the same time. There are a lot of newsletters that are based on a subscription model where you either pay per newsletter or you pay monthly. I think this branches out from the Patreon boom from around the same time that you could see the writing on the wall about funding in media.
Yeah.
And some people can get really successful this way. I have a YouTuber ex-boyfriend that is rich enough to buy a house now, which is cool for him, but not cool for me because I don't have that money. And we had an interesting launch where we were either prepared for it to be an obvious immediate failure or for it to be just a money faucet we turned on. And it turned out to be like, it's a kind of a thing where we had immediate buy-in from people who are already fans of us, but the number is going up in a much slower way than we anticipated.
Yeah.
So we are not yet at this place of stability that we want to be at, where this can just be our full-time job. But it's also clear that, as Riley likes to say, the blogs are our money. We make good blogs, and then money gets to us from those blogs.
Amazing.
And as long as we keep writing the blogs, which is always the thing we always said in, like, union meetings and meetings with executive editors, like, as long as we keep writing the blogs, people will read them, and you'll get the returns that you want to have on the blogs.
Yeah.
And that is true. And I think we are still in the middle of this shift.
Okay.
I wish we could have found someone to invest in us a little bit. But you can also see how that goes wrong easily.
Yeah.
Because,
you are also very young as a site. You guys announced some financials relatively recently, right?
We didn't announce hard numbers, but subscriber numbers. Yeah. We're almost the subscriber number where we can start making merch, which makes me really excited because we have a cool logo.
Yeah.
We've been around since November, so it's only been like 6 or 7 months, basically.
Yeah.
And so the growth is really encouraging because it's happening much sooner than I thought it would.
Yeah.
But it's also just like, I'm 34. Yeah. You know, well, I have bills.
So what is the difference in terms of how you are reaching that audience and growing that audience now versus in the old days?
So we like to think of it, so we have a free newsletter, and then we have a bunch of stuff that goes out to people who are paying for us. We have bonus episodes for our podcast. We have a community Discord. We also paywalled commenting. So if you want to comment on our articles, you have to give us at least $7, which is incredible for our sanity. Our community is really, really nice suddenly. We have good comments, which I like having. And so it's mostly about getting that audience we've already captured that are signing up for free and then trying to convince them to pay. So part of that is we do a weekly live stream on Twitch and we solicit questions from our Discord and we continually talk about that. And then we also release that as a podcast. And then we also send our free subscribers like a free blog. There's only a certain number of blogs that you can read on the site for free before you get a paywall. But we try to be as generous as possible so that you can see as much of the content you want and decide you want to be a part of the broader community. It's more like you are selling the site not just as we are cool writers doing cool things, but we are a community of people that are all thinking the same way about video games. Video games is interesting because it's like one of the most popular forms of entertainment on Earth, but all of the websites where you get to read news about it, it's often really dry. The criticism is frequently not very good. The business journalism is pretty interesting sometimes, but there's not very many journalists that are very good at it. There's maybe like Jason Schreier at Bloomberg.
I imagine though for like with Vice or, you know, a larger site when they were alive and running, one of the benefits of a major media outlet like that is the money behind it so that they have ads out there so that they're reaching eyeballs on, you know, different channels. So without that, how do you find your target audience? Do you like drop into gaming world and certain
niches? Yeah, we're trying to take advantage of the ecosystem of fandom that already exists in the world of video games. You know, we're lucky in that people who play video games are pretty I guess, tribal is a way to describe them, sure. where they can be really obsessive, and they also have a tendency to sort of surround themselves like around specific personalities and really latch on to them. So if we got, I mean, this will never happen, but if we got someone like Hassan Piker on our podcast, then that means that we're inviting Hassan Piker's audience to listen to our podcast and become introduced to us. Some of these people might not be familiar with us, and then they might join our free community or our paid community, and that's a really big boon. But it's also just that we are offering people who like video games who are normal a website to read about them in a way that is normal, where you don't have to deal with people who are going to argue with you about how large a video game character's breasts should be or whatever. We are just going to talk about them and play them like adults and provide a source for you to think about them as an adult person, an adult human being. And hopefully, you know, you see some benefit in that. I think that is a untapped market, mostly because we don't think about people who are like playing Candy Crush on their phones as like valid parts of this audience, but they are. They're just alienated by everyone calling each other racial slurs on Twitch. So it's hopefully unique enough that it'll survive. It's very encouraging so far. I'm really excited.
I subscribe to Polyester Zine. I don't know if anyone's familiar with that one. It's out of the UK. It's like a femme niche online zine. Mm-hmm. And all topics that you would never find in any of the major media outlets. But I have no interest in reading anything about Donald Trump ever again. So it's fine with me. But I feel like right now, I guess my question is, I feel like the internet has been getting smaller and smaller since it launched. And, you know, now the first page of Google is essentially, there's like no way to get on that unless you're a major corporation. But do we feel like now it's starting to get bigger again? Like it's unfolding?
I think we're just seeing like Usenet too, essentially. You know, people are so frustrated with being thrust into a big chat room with a bunch of other people that aren't necessarily people they want to make community with, right? Like you get on Twitter and I limit replies to all of my tweets because you either get hardcore pornography in your replies or people calling you racial slurs. You know, like it's a cesspool. A lot of people are siloing themselves off, therefore, into smaller communities like Discord servers or forums or private federated social media, et cetera. So this is not too dissimilar from how the internet was when it was just a bunch of nerds at MIT, right? Like they create Usenet channels, Usenet servers for whatever hobby they're interested in and engage in the internet specifically in that way at that time. It does feel like people are beginning to try to surface things that I know have always been on the internet, which is weird covens of people who are deeply obsessed with really, really specific things. And I think the Web 2.0 experiment, what it really served to do was to put the hands of that information, or at least the ability to host that information, in the hands of a couple of different corporations, which then tried to stifle anything that could not make money, that could not. Facebook couldn't give a fuck if you are hosting an explicit fan fiction community for X-Files until the moment that it gets them negative press. And then they will step in and they will strangle that baby in the crib. Like, they don't care about that. But you used to be able to just buy a domain name and get a little web hosting space and upload all the fan fiction about Scully and Mulder that you wanted, you know?
And yet somehow Facebook is just really fine with hundreds of thousands of people just creating AI images of little boys making Jesus out of eggs.
I love it. I love the Jesus crabs.
Yeah.
I love those. So I love, actually, my favorite are the tiny houses or lofted apartments that don't make sense. Like, you can't figure out how to get to the second part of the apartment. That's great. That's a really great example of how the internet has just become sludge that is dominated by a couple of different people, essentially.
Right. Well, and it sounds like you're basically making the argument that people are reverse engineering the internet as it exists in order to go back to a kinder, gentler, yes. nicer time
yes.
when
yes.
things were actually just good or yeah. or a little better, at least.
It just, it was easier to find your people on the internet. It was easier. You did not have to be thrust into communication with a bunch of 17-year-olds that have never paid taxes before, that are afraid of, like, they don't like sex scenes in movies because they have to watch movies with their parents or whatever. I would not have to talk to a 17-year-old unless I really wanted to. And I don't. I, like, really don't want to.
Yeah, so 17-year-olds who are listening, don't write in.
Please don't.
We don't want to hear from you.
Just wait a couple years, and then maybe you'll be on my level.
So one of the main challenges of waiting for this, I don't know, this new reimagined internet that we would like to recreate for ourselves is parallel to the challenge of any individual participant in this new internet. And that is that it takes time for that to form, especially when people need to make a living off of it. It takes time for money to arrive in the slower ways it arrives when it has to be, I don't know, honestly come by people who just want to give you money for the things you do. So absent an environment where, you know, investment in huge returns or, you know, selling a property to some corporate owner that makes it no longer member-owned, worker-owned, how do we think about buying that time? How do we get ourselves enough time to extricate ourselves from an environment that has been designed to turn profit but has failed to do so in meaningful amounts to the investing public? How do these small groups of people, how do these worker-owned concerns buy themselves the time to exist long enough to try to get enough money to sustain?
A couple different things, right? And I think it's really dependent on, like, which individual publication you're looking at. And also, should we do, like, a quick rundown just of, like, because I feel like we're talking about So there's a Racket, which is based in Minnesota, that was founded in 2021. There's Hellgate, which does sort of a local New York City news akin to the dearly departed Village Voice. There's Defector, which we mentioned. It came out of Deadspin when the entire staff of Deadspin quit en masse from Geo Media a couple of years back. 404.
Yes, yeah, which is former Motherboard people. I worked at Motherboard. So they also, all four of them quit and started this website together.
Which, as far as I can tell, it was immediately successful.
Yeah, no, they said 6 months later they're profitable, yeah, which is incredible.
Yeah, the point mostly being that I think that there are a lot of different models that people are using. Yeah. I know some of these places have been fairly successful in getting grant funding because there is, depending on what you are aiming at, you know, there can be funding for that kind of stuff. Oh, there's also Discourse Blog, right, which is former Splinter people. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of people hold down part-time jobs or will take contract work while they're sort of working to get these things off the ground. And also, like, you know, even when you're thinking about these subscription models, something that I have seen, at least in my limited work with Hellgate, is that you really have people like your content, but also we're sort of in a moment where I think that some subscriptions are just coming from people being really excited to be able to see something that's sort of existing outside of the ecosystem as it has, you know, been going for the course of our careers, certainly.
Yeah.
I think also people miss magazines, like real magazines. We used to get a copy of Newsweek at our house every week, and it was sick. Like, it was there was, like, actual articles in there, and they were very informative. Yeah. I was, like, 14, and I was, like, really up on the news suddenly. And now you look at Newsweek, and it's a pamphlet, and it sucks. Yeah. People miss the experience of paying for something and feeling like it's really special when you get it. Mm. We experimented at Motherboard a little bit with sending out a zine, like a physical zine to people, and that was one of the most fun things we did. It wasn't profitable at all, but there's enthusiasm for that kind of a thing, for feeling like you belong to a special club, essentially. Mm-hmm. And even if they don't read the articles or don't visit the site enough to make it quote-unquote worth it, it's a conversation we had a lot internally at Aftermath, is like, we have to fight against the idea. The real phrasing we used is actually, the big board cannot hurt you anymore. Mm-hmm. Like, we don't have to care about clicks in the same way that we used to. We don't need these articles to quote-unquote chart. We don't have analytics like we used to. We just need to make sure that the people who pay for us feel like it's quote-unquote worth it. Mm. And we can't define for them what worth it means. We have a really high subscription, the benefactor tier, which is, if you want to just give us $1,000, please do. And we gave them all these special perks, but none of them wanted them. Hmm. Like, we were like, we can have a chat with you once a month or once a quarter, and you can ask us any questions you want. And only one person came, and he was like, I didn't really want to do this, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, but just, like, on the sort of the question of how people are making this work. Like, it is, you know, it is probably not ideal that there are so many out-of-work journalists, but it is kind of interesting to watch. You know, there's Your choices, you know, at this point, if you get laid off by one of these big media slash tech companies, is you can either like gig economy for just yourself and like be a freelancer and like take contract work, or you can like gig together, which is sort of like what I feel like we're seeing with people sort of like coming together, creating these collectives, being like, you know what, even if we have to do piecework on the side, like this is sort of, this is a project that is worth pursuing.
Yeah.
No, I'm here and Luke has a second job. Nathan is writing a book. Riley is the only one of us that spends like 11 hours a day doing business math, which is what he would love to do. So I think that's perfectly suited for him. The goal, eventually, we would love for this to be our full-time job, but the economy's not there, you know? And that's perfectly fine. I mean, we are brand new. Little babies, just 7 months old. And I think people always joke that if you want to be a journalist, you better marry somebody that is rich, basically. That's always been true. And now it's just like, we need to share more tips about how we're making it by at our other gigs while we are trying to struggle through the media landscape right now.
That sort of reminds me of the early days of Gather. I've been doing work with Gather for, I think, about a decade now. And certainly when it was a smaller establishment and I was first working here, it was people in similar parts of their consulting career with similar opportunities trying to figure out if together we could do bigger, more stable, different, diversified things than what we were doing independently. And so there was this sort of natural coming together of like, hey, if we're like a shop and we're doing a little bit of this, can I also do that as well as the things I'm doing over here? The challenges then, and I think some of the enjoyable challenges that Gather has right now, is what happens when that scales, or does it need to scale, or should that even be the goal? And now Gather has scaled into something entirely different. And some of these media companies, I imagine, will hopefully have the problem of scale at some point.
Yeah, I mean, I think that scale is really interesting because at this point, we're really in the infancy of a lot of these worker-owned media concerns. And there's a question of what it will look like if you have 20 people in your newsroom and you're all not just like best buddies working together. A lot of these places are, you know, I'm just starting. A couple of me and my friends, we sort of are all on the same page. You know, and also there's a, like, this is a little bit different than what we're talking about with Gather, but I think that when you look at these organizations in contrast to sort of large institutional newsrooms, you know, you don't have funding for like investigative journalism, really. You're sort of operating on a different scale. And so I think it's been cool to see various partnerships happen. Like, I know Hellgate just did one with Type Investigates to put together an amazing package about our corrupt mayor. Mm-hmm. And I think it's cool to be able to see the sort of like cross-pollination between all of these different organizations.
Well, okay, I'm glad that you brought up the human aspect of scale here as you introduce more people to your very bespoke arrangement of how you can work together and what your shared goals are. There are more human challenges that get added to the mix. And we're going to go to a break here quickly. But after the break, Kirsten has just released the written Gather Dispatch this month that is about how to work with difficult people in your workplace. And in her own words, if that might be you. So when we come back, Kirsten's going to take us through that and we will solve more problems from your working life. Welcome back. We are back. Same room, same folks. The temperature is still increasing in here. Not even summer yet. You guys should see summer potting in this room.
Oof.
But anyway, Kirsten, you just released the newest Gather Dispatch edition. Please be so kind as to tell those of the audience who have not read it already what you covered.
Giving himself away. He hasn't even read it. we just released the Q2 Gather Dispatch. In the first quarter, we did a dispatch on work-life balance and mental well-being at work and managing work-life balance. And one of the questions was what most influences your satisfaction at work. And the first response, trailing just behind the number one response, which was the amount of work I have, which makes sense, was the people that I work with and for and the health of those relationships. Mm. And I felt like that was sort of the elephant in the room in the entire discussion anyway. I see so many blog posts and articles on mental well-being at work, or maybe even less so on mental well-being or even that phrase, but just work-life balance. And usually it's tips on like do's and don'ts and boundaries. But often what's not spoken about in these pieces is the fact that sometimes you work with people that are really difficult and really awful. And how do you have work-life balance if your boss doesn't allow it or if the company culture is not there? I kind of went off on a tangent, which is my typical way of doing things. And Jason said, this is really its own piece, so we should move it to the next one. And we did. And so this dispatch was conflict at work and dealing with difficult people and knowing when it's you. Because I think it's everyone in this room knows that we deal with challenging people and conflict at work is inevitable. But also, there is part of the conversation that needs some light shown on it as well, which is sometimes it's us too. We all grow in relationship. You know, we don't grow on our own. Conflict is actually, the piece explores a door to resolution, if we look at it that way. And so if we can reframe conflict as a door to resolution and as the first sign to take that step, then we can see it as an opportunity to understand something more deeply, the situation at hand and how to solve it, another person, and your own self, and arguably all three of those things at all times. And then we interviewed IBM's inbound content director, Ellie Trickett, who is entering the coaching space and also is just a really wonderful leader. I worked under her during 2020 when we had to transition Think during the pandemic. It was like 8 weeks out. We had to move the 100,000 person in-person event online. And she did it. She led our team with like grace, with humor, with a strategic eye and great creative direction. And I still work with her now on the blog. It's been 4 years now. So she provided some great input too. And a lot of what we talked about in our session was, how do you know when it's you? Mm-hmm. And it was like, well, if everyone you meet is an asshole, then it might be time to look in the mirror, you know?
No. Yeah. Uh-oh.
Yeah.
This room is feeling some type of way about that.
You know, hopefully I'll never have to deal with this ever again, but I have been in situations where my boss is very difficult. And I know that I love conflict and am ready to go at basically a moment's notice, but that's not necessarily a professional way to deal with conflict. Like, how do you move through conflict, especially when the person that is creating conflict with you is someone who you have to report to?
When you say you love conflict, you're ready to go, just so I understand, does that mean you're like...
I'm like,
tell
hold my purse.
Like, right.
Hold my purse, let's go.
Let's go. I'm rising to the occasion. I will fight with you. Like, I really want to. Because I feel very strongly about my opinions, and I know that I can argue them. And I also, like, I'm a non-man in the workplace, and I'm Black. And I always feel really defensive when I'm challenged because I know that I'm going to be challenged and, like, judged more harshly than some of my peers. So it sometimes becomes difficult for me to know when should I stick up for myself or when I need to let it be, like, water off a duck's back and just sort of accept that this person is difficult and try to move on with my life otherwise.
Yeah, well, listening to you, you already sound really self-reflexive. The fact that you know that, you know, get defensive often, that's your first reaction. Just being aware of that, you're already ahead of the majority of people. You know, most people don't even recognize that, oh, this is a feeling that's going to pass and I know what I can attribute it to. They just react. Your first question, how do I deal with a difficult person when they're my boss?
Yeah.
That's sort of the meat of the piece that we get into eventually, which is any conflict, regardless of who it's between, the first step is really being aware of what the conflict is about. Is it a, and there's words for this that I'm forgetting, but there's a type of conflict that's like, is it task-oriented, where we're disagreeing on how this task gets done, or is it a personality conflict? You know, is it that this person is bullying, they're micromanaging, that kind of thing? We underestimate how much one person in a dynamic can change the dynamic in any relationship. How we show up and slow down, that's probably like the first thing that I would say. I'm like you. I definitely have like, I'm quick to, Jason knows this too. I'll be like, hey, what the fuck?
Yeah,
very quickly.
I'm terrified to be in this room.
As you should be. But so I'll tell you from personal experience, what works for me, what I try to do is slow down, take a break, pause. That's always a good way to go about it, and come back to the situation when you're regulated and you're ready to move forward with your solution. If it's your boss and it's a task-related issue, I would still present what you feel, you know, the path that you want to go and make your case, but just give yourself the grace and the space to kind of come back to baseline, take 5 minutes away from the computer if you're remote, or just go out for a cup of coffee to like get back in your regulated space. Because I'm using these like therapy words, but it's true. Like, we do conflict in the workspace. An interesting stat that we came across was that upwards of 75 to 80% of Americans are very stressed, and 25% of them like stressed to the level of your health is in danger. And so we're all teetering on the edge. And a quarter of those people named work as the biggest stressor in their life. Also, everyone in this room is probably also finds that like unsurprising.
I feel like also when you're under stress, it becomes harder for you to know when to take a break and to take that moment away from the computer to come back to baseline.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, I had a conversation with my therapist last week. I was in a big like crunch week, self-inflicted, but it was like every single night of this week. And I was also like traveling back and forth to the city. A lot of things were happening. So I worked like an 8 to midnight day, like 3 days in a row. And I had this conversation with my therapist where I said, I'm starting to like it. It felt good after the third day of this, and I know that is bad.
Yep. It's addictive. Yeah.
I know I have to not feel that way because—
Anger.
Yeah.
Stress. There are these addictive feelings.
Yes, exactly. But I felt myself turn the corner on that. And that's why it's hard to know when to step away,
it's
because the only solution to stress is to do it harder, to do it more.
Yeah.
And then to like it.
Oh, and, yes. You know, and a big thing that we learned in the survey is that where people are coming from when they're dealing with difficult people, a lot of it is actually, like, with work-life balance. We had one of the Gather quotes talking about, it was Matt Dinello, talked about a company that he had worked at where the CEO said, it's up to you to figure out your work-life balance. And he kind of initially was like, well, that seems unfair, like, it's kind of like the limitless vacation policy. People are like, can I actually use it? But I actually am very much for that kind of thinking, because ultimately it does have to be within each person. We have to have awareness. We have to be present. These are things that sound, that can sound woo-woo, that can sound like they belong in a therapy session. But the truth of the matter is that we all work and live like in these same spaces with these same bodies and minds and systems that react. And so being present is the first step, being aware. And then once you're aware of that, you have to practice it. And most of us are probably going to have to practice for the rest of our lives. So giving grace and recognizing that it's not a straight line, and then becoming aware of those triggers, slowing down the response, and then coming back, re-entering the situation just when you're in a more level place.
You want to know a quote that actually gets me through some difficult situations with people that are frustrating? It's Marcus Aurelius, which he gets a bad rap, which I understand. There's a lot of really fucking weird people. Love him. But my husband has gotten a lot of stoicism, and there's one quote, whenever I'm dealing with a work task that has me interfacing with people that I don't necessarily wouldn't talk to you by choice, I would say. Every day you will meet people who do not know the difference between good and evil. Then that's just true. But I do know the difference between good and evil, and I don't need to internalize whatever it is that these people are bringing over here to me. Yeah. I know where I stand, and I do not need to meet these other people with whatever it is they're carrying around with them.
Sure.
And I think that you just touched on two perfect tips that I would also give people dealing with someone difficult, especially if it's a boss. Don't take it personally.
Mm-hmm.
And don't make assumptions, you know, because one thing that came up in the conversation with Ellie was how often we have conversations with people in our heads.
Yeah.
And when we're doing that, we're filling in their piece of the dialogue with our biases.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so we're not allowing that room for change or evolution or for that dynamic to shift.
You know, Gita, I believe you know the difference between good and evil.
I think I do.
I take you at your word. However, don't most people believe that they do? And yet some of them are the assholes.
Yeah. There's a quote. Okay, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I'm very curious about asshole rehabilitation here.
Yeah. How do we know if everyone, and some people don't, some people are proud of just like, oh, fuck it. You know, I don't care. My moral relativism ends where I give a shit. But like, how do we know if most people kind of believe that they are fine?
Well, do we need to know? Do we need to have a definitive ruling on who's an asshole and who's not, because it's subjective to some degree, right?
Sure. I guess let's be less.
We're not Am I the Asshole Reddit right here.
Which is my favorite Reddit thread. And my entire Instagram homepage is Am I the Asshole.
Perfect. All right. Well, let's be more enlightened then. Let's pin it to the behavior, not the person. How do you know when your behavior is that of an asshole?
Well, I actually want to meet Gita's quote on not everybody knows the difference between good and evil, but I do, so I don't need to take it personally. I love that. And I also might say, too, like turning it outward, a kind of different quote is, don't assign ill will or evil towards something that you can attribute to stupidity.
Yes.
Yep. Which I think is also linked to compassion. And that's really important, too. So having compassion for other people, like I remind myself, too, sometimes that I am not so important.
Yeah.
That this is about me.
Other people are just not thinking about you.
Are just not thinking about you, and they just might not have like any like etiquette of their own with Slack or whatever else it is.
Yeah, how do we know if all of us are the main characters in our own lives and know the reasons why we do things? What are the flags? How do we know when perhaps we're the asshole in the room?
I think it's a spectrum. Not always, but in most cases there's some shared responsibility for the outcome of like a conversation or and how people feel about it. So how do you know for sure? The quote I said before, if everyone you meet is an asshole, it might be time to look in the mirror. And just if you're constantly coming up on frustrating situations, and granted, you know, for a Black woman, you're going to come up on frustrating conversations a lot more than a white man. So that's not an indicator that you're an asshole because you deal with it more, obviously. But if you run up against similar frustrations that you can't quite attribute sensibly or to like, you know, okay, I'm dealing with this because people aren't expecting me to enter the room this way or the conversation this way.
I try to think of it as like strategies. What are the tactics I'm using? I think about it in like organizing terms, essentially, you know. In organizing, there is an escalation chart. You know, I've thought about that chart so much. Yeah. And if my first try is not working for me to resolve whatever conflict I'm having with another person, then I need to escalate to the next part of the chart and think, maybe in the next time I talk to them, we need to talk specifically about what happened and I can talk about what I think I did wrong and what they did wrong, et cetera. Whatever it is, to move forward past whatever conflict has occurred rather than just stewing in it and then approaching the same problem in the same way every time.
That's a great point. And it's also like there's different mediums of communication too. And sometimes it helps to give things a little bit of a break. And sometimes you need to know, okay, this is just not going to work, this relationship, and it needs to end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know? The mediums of communication is really a good point also. I know that lots of people come off rude in Slack without meaning to.
Mm-hmm.
And I also know sometimes when I'm talking to people, I come off as really blunt without meaning to also. And I feel like I express myself better in the written word because that's what I just do all day, every day. I know how to explain myself pretty well.
Same.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But then you remove 70% of the, you know, nonverbal communication too.
Yeah, exactly. Which, you know, I'm glad we're doing this podcast in a room, for example, because when I try to do podcasts and we're all just on Discord in different places in New York, it's harder to know when someone is speaking. It's harder to know what their tone of voice meant. Their facial cues are a lot of what communication is. And human beings see the face of Jesus in pancakes. Like, we're always looking for, we're looking for patterns and we're looking for confirmation of our biases. You know, we are looking for human faces because our brain recognizes the pattern of a human face very easily. And when you assume that people are mad at you, then you'll see evidence of them being mad at you in everything that is going on. And then you might end up being a jerk to every single person that you talk to that day.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can assure the three of you that I have never been mad at you.
Oh, thank you.
Welcome. I thought about every memory I had, and I'm coming up with nothing.
I know. I just feel like that can't possibly be true, but it might be.
I mean, the day is young.
One thing, too, is with conflict, we find that if we just acknowledge it, too, that can go a long way. Just being like, okay, clearly we have a little bit of a rift here. Can we talk about it? Saying that can ease a lot of the tension. And I think that's something that we're going to see much more of in all of our different workplaces going forward, especially as millennials are, you know, moving into leadership positions and we're more comfortable having these conversations. But just the evolution of reframing conflict as opportunity and, using it as such.
thank you all for coming in. This was a tremendous delight. Kirsten, thank you as always. Yeah. Molly, Gita, thank you for being first-time guests. Let's hope that's not the last time.
I love podcasting, so just
hell yeah.
Give me free food and I'll be here. So <I'll take>
it. It is the least that we can do. And finally, to our dear listeners who have bared with me in all of my behaviors, which I will now reflect on for the rest of the day, thank you, as always, for listening to another episode of The Gathered Dispatch. And I have one and only one thing to ask of you in my nicest tones. If you found any of this edifying, if you liked parts of it, think of one person you think would enjoy this and suggest they give a listen. Thank you very much. We will see you next month. Bye.